Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and it's either good or bad for the former Prime Minister of Israel, Ehud Barak, that his new memoir is coming out right at this time when there is so much Israel news. The controversial opening today of the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem on the 70th anniversary of the country itself, 6 weeks of protests in Gaza that have left at least 50 Palestinians dead and thousands wounded are peaking today as they march toward the border and Israeli troops fire on them. And there is Israel's military confrontation with Iran in Syria last week. So we will do our best in this conversation to respect the fact that Ehud Barak put years of work into writing down the very consequential activities of his lifetime. And we will also seize the opportunity of having someone so relevant to so much news of this very day. The book is called My Country, My Life, Fighting for Israel, Searching for Peace. And among many other things, it tells new stories of risky clandestine military operations that contributed to Barak becoming Israel's most decorated soldier ever and rising to Army Chief of Staff and Minister of Defense, and how the Israelis and Palestinians came so close to a two-state solution while Barak was prime minister and Bill Clinton was president in the year 2000. So here we go. Prime Minister Barak, hello, and thank you so much for coming on WNYC.
Thank you for having me.
You were 6 years old 70 years ago today when Israel became a state. Do you have any memory of it or what it meant to you as a child?
Yeah, I have very vivid memory from the evening of 29th of November when the General Assembly passed the critical vote about establishing the state, and immediately the next day a war opened. It didn't hurt the kibbutz, a rural kind of communal place where I lived. But even as a 6 year old, it was clear that something dramatic that never happened since the biblical times is happening around us and in front of our eyes. And there was a great sense of dramatic event.
How did your parents wind up in Israel?
My mother came from Poland as a member of a youth movement called Gordonia, which tried not just to turn the character of a Jewish individual from all this Luftgeschäft into actual working and farming.
What's that word?
Luftgeschäft, the air businesses, kind of the typical Jewish businesses in the diaspora in Eastern Europe. But she came to change the nature of the Jewish people as well as to uplift human nature beyond its limitations. My father came several years earlier from Lithuania. He was orphan. His parents murdered before the first war. And he came as a student for the budding Hebrew University in Jerusalem and ended up in a kibbutz where he couldn't stand the contradiction between studying whatever history or philosophy and the great event that happens around him, even in
the history and the philosophy felt too intellectually removed.
No, he remained somewhat intellectual all along his life, and probably the source of my curiosity about sciences and history, philosophy, and so on. But he basically left it, and they all, both of them, kind of dedicated their life to this project of building the state of Israel as pioneers in a kibbutz, which at the time was a totally deprived neighborhood, like permanent summer camp for adults.
When did you become aware that for the Palestinian Arabs, your Independence Day became known as their Nakba, or the catastrophe to them?
You know, as a young kid, even before the establishment of the State of Israel, we have some 300 yards from our kibbutz. There was an Arab village named Wadi Hawaret. And we used to visit there as kindergarten kids, accompanied by our, you know, we were brought up in the kibbutz in a children nursery. There was no one was belonging just to his parents. There was a communal. So our metapelet, it was called, the caretaker, took us to the Arab village quite often. So we could see the Arabs. And I never felt hatred from them. They were benign people. And I didn't know that we are supposed to hate them, but immediately after the beginning of the war, they disappeared. And the Arab village, as we call it, ended up empty. But I want to add to it a point that I noticed even then, and it continued until 2000 when we met with Arafat and Clinton and so on. The argument about the Nakba, the disaster, the Nakba was a self-made disaster for the Palestinians. Basically, the General Assembly decision about the partition plan to create two states in the British Mandate Palestine, an Arab state and a Jewish state, was accepted by Ben Gurion, our founding father leader, kind of in spite of the fact that the Jewish state was supposed to be three cantons, hardly connected to each other, without Jerusalem, without even a corridor to Jerusalem. Ben Gurion accepted it on behalf of the Jewish people. The Arab Palestinians and neighboring countries did not accept and deliberately attacked the baby before it could stand on its feet in order to kill him. So, as I told Arafat years later, I told, you know, Mr. President, you had not yet been born. Arafat was a teenager. I was a young kid. I will remember it. We will never be apologetic about surviving these attempts on our life. So morally, we are not. We will never accept responsibility for the creation of the refugee problem.
So didn't histories emerge decades later that at the same time what you just described was taking place, that there were also efforts on the part of the new Jewish state to expel the Arabs or give them various reasons that they would feel they wanted to leave?
Well, you mean during the war or after the war?
I think in that whole period.
No, that's why I emphasize the cause of the whole process. If the Arabs would accept the partition plan as well as Ben-Gurion accepted it, we probably would have living through totally yes. different history. So there is certain responsibility, even in history, and it sits on the shoulders of the Arabs. As a result of the same war that 650,000 Palestinians left what became Israel, during these very 2 years and the 2 years afterwards, 650,000 Jews came from all over the Arab world and landed into Israel, doubling its population within 3 years. We never called them refugees. We called them brothers. And together with their offspring, they are now majority of the Israeli population. The problem of making the refugees issue never solved and kind of eternal process is basically a major default of Palestinian and Arab politics.
My guest is former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak. His new memoir is called My Country, My Life, Fighting for Israel, Searching for Peace. We can take a few phone calls for him at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. With all that's going on right now, the 70th anniversary of Israel today, plus the trouble in Gaza and the shootings there by Israeli troops, plus the movement of the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem this very day, plus Iran last week. What are your emotions? How complicated are your feelings today?
Yeah, it's an extremely intensive several weeks before the kind of the dates which makes it exactly 70 years after the establishment of this state, and the accumulation of events that telling you that, you know, the Middle East, as we experienced all along our existence, is a tough neighborhood. No mercy for the weak, no second chance for those who cannot defend themselves. The Mid East is not the Midwest. It's totally different arena. But the same way that a person cannot choose his parents, a nation cannot choose its neighbors. They are whoever they are, and we have to settle there. So it's a tough tough place. You have to be always alert. The only precondition for existence is being strong. But having said that, because we are surrounded by so many enemies, and we are the exception in the region in a way, we are the party who has interest in relaxing the conflict. We should be able, as Ben Gurion once defined it, to win every war while the other side can win one. And there is no need for any more wars.
If the Arabs won one, Israel would have ceased to exist.
Yeah,
is the point.
So we have to win every war, but we are the ones who have an interest to develop, to flourish, to strengthen during the intervals between wars. So we are the party who doesn't have any interest in wars, but we have to fight. So it's a highly emotional period, especially with the decision to move the embassy to Jerusalem, or something at a sore kind of point for 70 years now. Because we thought it should have happened the moment we announced it as our capital. Now, I know that it alienates the Arabs and the Palestinians, the fact that America moved the embassy to Jerusalem. But there is no reason for this as well, because it does not exclude, even explicitly in the statements of the White House, it does not exclude the possibility that once there is a Palestinian state, wherever their capital will be set or sit or defined, there will be American embassy there.
That's an important point. And one of the things that you offered when you came so close to the peace agreement in 2000 was Jerusalem as a shared capital, right? And are you saying that Trump's decision to move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem does not preclude the possibility that some future peace agreement would wind up with a shared or divided by where the population lives, Jerusalem, and the Palestinians could have it as their capital too?
Yeah, in a way that's true, of course. The way that everything will be divided should come as a result of negotiation, be agreed by two sides. But if there's an agreement that certain Arab heavily habitated neighborhoods becomes a part of a Palestinian state and Palestinian capital, and they could even widen it and call it Al-Quds, which is Jerusalem in Arabic. Just let it be so. It's up to them.
And the Gaza situation, and you mentioned Israel needing to win every war to continue to exist. I don't know if you count this as a war, but the Gaza situation is raising anew old questions of the proportionality of Israel's military response. The numbers I've seen are over 50 Palestinians killed since March 30th, 7,000 injured, and zero Israelis even hurt. And people are asking, how is that moral?
Yeah, it's moral because we have no other practical, no other choice, especially those like me who believe that we should not control over the Palestinians, that we should delineate a line within the promised land within which we'll have most of our security and interests and settlers and have a solid Jewish majority, but beyond which there will be a Palestinian future viable state. So whoever believes in two states believe in a line that will turn into a border with some fence or some barrier. And the need to respect borders is crucial to any possibility of a stable agreement.
But you so feel that the government is using the minimum possible amount of force in this situation?
For sure, that's the effort to do. But when it comes, you know, riot control means are developed, and we have it as any other kind of advanced force to deal with riots, even thousands of people in distance of few yards, 10 yards, 30 yards, 50 yards. We do not have means developed for dealing with riot control in over a distance of 500 yards and 100,000 people. That's not possible. You cannot afford let them cross the border and go into Israel freely. So we might be regretting not getting a much longer early warning for it, which might enable develop certain means. But with the present means, I know what a huge effort is invested in the IDF in the recent weeks to minimize the amount of fatalities, especially about this day, the very
today
one that we are now in, and probably tomorrow when it comes to its height, and probably several dozens killed today. You can regret it, but you cannot find it not legitimate or justified once a border is deliberately crossed by violent people in a way that will make borders meaningless.
And yet you are not a supporter of Netanyahu. You're a leader of the other party, Labor Party. Your book argues...
I was the leader.
You
I'm
were.
Not a leader you, now. I'm now in...
Private citizen.
Private citizen in... security-related
yes.
cyber security startups, and writing books.
But you still consider yourself?
Yeah. I express my views. You know, I adapted from your president because of the jet lag. I wake up sometimes 2 o'clock in the morning, so I tweet something to encourage discussion and draw the attention of people to the mistakes of our government.
So when we come back from a break, then I want to ask you why you write in the book that the two-state solution, unlike I think what Netanyahu would say, is more urgent for Israel as well as its neighbors than ever before. My guest is former Prime Minister of Israel Ehud Barak, and his new book is My Country, My Life, Fighting for Israel, Searching for Peace. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with the former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak. His new book, My Country, My Life, Fighting for Israel, Searching for Peace. And as we said before the break, your book argues that the two-state solution is more urgent than ever, not just for the Palestinians, but for the existential interest of Israel itself. By rediscovering the twin pillars on which it was built, military strength and moral purpose, can Israel thrive? What do you have in mind?
Yeah, basically it's a part of realities. If you look at the direction that our government is supposedly lead us toward one state, the whole area between River Jordan and Mediterranean have only one entity named Israel reigning over it. This will become inevitably, that's the key word, inevitably, either non-Jewish or non-democratic. Probably no one takes seriously the case of non-Jewish because if the Arabs vote, it's a binational state immediately and within short time with Arab majority. So the other alternative, I don't want to use the term from a neighboring continent in the previous century, but it's not democracy. If we are waning permanently about millions of Palestinians who have their own national aspiration. So the only way to deal with it is basically to delineate a line within the promised land, as I mentioned, within which we'll cover our strategic needs and our most of the settlers, and probably compensate with certain land swaps the Palestinians, and beyond which there will be a place for a vibrant Palestinian state. So this is crucial because the possibility of turning into either binational state, which is like Belfast or Bosnia or non-democratic state, and once again there were examples as well, that's a tragedy. I can tell you more than this. In the last 3 years we have purely right-wing government, no coalition government, no excuses anymore. They cannot say Tzipi Livni, which is the head of one of the party, Yair Lapid, or Barak, block the government from doing what should be done. So you see the purposeful attempt to continue the isolated settlements activity, which are beyond this line that I have just described, and deliberately trying to close the door on any possibility of arrangement. We need to disengage from the Palestinians, not because of the Palestinians' justice or needs, because the need to define our own identity as a Jewish democratic state. The only way is to settle for more land and more unity and holding on to the moral high ground in the world and in the region.
Dar in Manhattan. You're on WNYC with Ehud Barak. Hello, Dar.
Hey, how are you? Thank you for putting me on. My question is, does at this point the support of the right-wing Christian movement in the U.S., is it at all helpful or is it detrimental to the peace process? I mean, I actually think Trump did this for them, not for Israel, but moving the embassy is in the prophecies, and they really have different goals than you. They seek the annihilation of Israel.
You know, we, for many years, we were so short on support in the world that even the evangelical movement, they are so determined, devoted supporters, that we cannot underestimate their importance for us. But having said that, I should tell you that when I was prime minister at a certain point, they told me we are going to bring 8,000 people of our movement. We want a great place to make a big event. So I told them, we don't have one roof for 8,000 people in Israel. So I propose we will arrange some amphitheater in a place called Har Megiddo, which is the original Armageddon place, and joked with them that I will come and thank them and for everything that they are doing and tell them we are all the way with them except for the last chapter.
The last chapter where all the Jews are annihilated because they don't convert to Christianity.
You know, we cannot afford losing any kind of support. We highly appreciate them. I think that they are doing positive. They have positive role for us, even if they are disputed here in this country.
Are Israeli Jews in a culture war among each other that mirrors the one here? Secularism and diversity versus Orthodox religion, like the evangelicals, and monoculture?
I think we have even a deeper chasm between secular and religious, because the issue of Jewishness is very profoundly related to the new Israel that we have built, something that you cannot find any other. It's not like being Protestant and American or being Catholic and Italian. And but we have to solve it among ourselves because we are one people. We are brothers ultimately. I call for more tolerance. There is a saying in Hebrew, Shivim Panim LaTorah, 70 faces to the Bible or the Torah. No one can tell anyone else how to behave as a Jew. It should be your personal choice. I would go for much more openness, much more tolerance. Whenever I sit on Friday evening in a Reform Jew, a family here, I tell my wife they are more Jewish than I am. I never had a bar mitzvah, never went to a synagogue, and I feel as Jewish as any extra ultra-Orthodox rabbi, and I don't accept the authority of anyone to tell me how to be a Jew. So I think we should be very open. What happened recently along the Kotel, the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem, the holiest place where American Jews, they cannot feel equal in this holy place, that's shame.
We just have a minute and a half left in the show. I understand that you, unlike Netanyahu, wanted the U.S. to stay in the Iran deal. Tell me if that's incorrect. But even in a larger sense, is there a new alignment in the Middle East with Israel and the Sunni Arab states on one side and Iran on the other? We have about a minute left.
I was more hawkish than Bibi about preparing even for attack on Iran, and I thought that a deal is a bad deal, but once it was signed, it became reality. The same applies to the recent decision of the president. Once he signed it, it's a new reality. We have to deal with what to do now. I think that in regard to the regional arrangement, we are missing a huge opportunity, once in a generation kind of opportunity, to make an agreement with the leading Sunnite Arab countries, Saudi Arabia, the Gulf States, Egypt, Jordan, based on common interests, which is apparent, to fight against radical Muslim terror, to corner the Iranians' hegemonic and nuclear intention, to join hands in big infrastructure project. But a precondition for this idea or vision to fly is that Israel will be ready to make sincere steps toward the Palestinians, not because the Arabs have a love affair with the Palestinians, because their publics have. And Arab moderate leaders do not feel safe in their own seats if they engage with Israel in the open without the Palestinians moving forward.
Ehud Barak, the former prime minister and much more in Israel, is now the author of My Country, My Life, Fighting for Israel, Searching for Peace. If you want to see him in person, he'll be speaking tonight at 6:30 with the Hudson Union Society and tomorrow night at 7:30 at the 92nd Street Y. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.